From the Los Angeles Times, this is The Envelope, the podcast, your ultimate guide to award season. I'm one of your hosts, Yvonne Villarreal.
And I'm your other host, Mark Olson. Every week, our podcast showcases key voices across both TV and film.
Okay, Mark, you're on duty today, and you talked with Rachel Brosnahan. If you've watched The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel on Amazon, you know her as Midge, a 1950s housewife turned stand-up comic.
That's right. And now she's producing and starring in the dramatic crime thriller, I'm Your Woman.
I got to run in platform heels down a really rickety old staircase and crawl on the floor in pools of fake blood and run into people and drag 200-pound men out of cars and slide around in a 1970s sedan. You know, I got to learn to shoot a gun. It was good fun.
Wow, it sounds like I'm Your Woman was quite the experience. I can't wait to listen to the rest of your chat, Mark. You know, I spoke with Rachel for our podcast, Can't Stop Watching, and she was such a fun interview. If you haven't heard that convo yet, go back and listen. In the meantime, we'll be back with Mark's conversation with Rachel after this short break. Mark's talk with Rachel Brosnahan is coming right up. But first, let's spend a minute, more or less, with our critic Glenn Whipp.
The Sundance Film Festival opens this week, and of course it's virtual, which means that's kind of good news. You can go if you want. You can buy tickets online. And usually Oscar contenders come out of Sundance. This year, I expect the movie Minari, which premiered at the 2020 Sundance Film Festival, to be nominated in some categories. But the weird thing is this year, the 2021 Sundance movies will show up at the 2021 Oscars because the Academy extended the eligibility all the way to the end of February. So we got two Sundances this year at the Oscars. And there's one movie at Sundance this year, I think, that's going to show up at the Oscars, and that is Judas and the Black Messiah. It's a historical drama about Black Panther leader Fred Hampton and a confidant named William O'Neill, who turns into an FBI informant. Daniel Kaluuya, who you probably remember from Get Out, he plays Hampton, and the great Lakeith Stanfield from Atlanta plays O'Neill. These guys are fantastic in the movie, as you'd expect, and unfortunately, you can't see it at Sundance. Tickets are sold out. But it will be on HBO Max February 12th. We'll be in theaters, if you're willing to risk your life, on February 12th. And I think if you're looking at this year's Sundance Film Festival for the 2021 Oscars, Judas and the Black Messiah is a movie you're going to need to watch.
Always love a bit of awards news from Glenn. But Mark, now it's your turn. Let's get to your conversation with Rachel Brosnahan.
Rachel, thanks so much for joining us today. And now I think for people who know you from your part in The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, your role and your performance in I'm Your Woman are going to feel like something very different. Did you like that? Is that something that drew you to the project?
Yeah, it was definitely a piece of it. That's always been something that's been exciting to me from the many years I was acting before The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, just the opportunity to find and reach inside of women who are so different and far away from each other. Like so many actors, I've always used to say that I never wanted to do the same thing twice, and I stand by that. And so I've loved the last couple of years playing this confident, fast-talking comedian, and this was a really exciting and challenging swing in a totally different direction.
It's funny, I was looking just at like your IMDb pages and the photos of all your different roles. It's like sometimes hard to tell that it's you from like role to role. Like, do you consider yourself sort of a transformative or like sort of chameleonic performer?
I would love to be considered that way. I feel like that's the dream. It's my favorite part about acting is being able to disappear so completely inside another character. And I love watching other actors perform who can do that. I feel like Philip Seymour Hoffman did that so beautifully. Fran McDormand does that for me. Emma Thompson, Viola Davis. they disappear so completely inside of their roles that it is sometimes challenging to recognize them between projects. And my favorite compliment, I'll take it as one, is when people say that they didn't know that it was the same actor in House of Cards and The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, or didn't realize that this film was the same person at first. I appreciate that. A lot of hair, very talented hair and makeup and wardrobe folks played an important hand in that too.
And just the 1970s style of I'm Your Woman must have felt very different from the kind of late 50s, early 60s styles of Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. If nothing else, I'd imagine they were much more comfortable.
Definitely. I got to wear pants, bell bottoms even.
It's really one of my favorite things about Julia Hart, the director of I'm Your Woman, about her as a filmmaker is that, like you're talking about, from movie to movie, her films are so different, the way they sort of jump from genre to genre. What was it, you know, about this script and working with her that appealed to you?
Her range is extraordinary. I'm so inspired by her trajectory. She started as a teacher and then moved into writing and then moved into writing and directing. And I'm inspired by her in a million ways, but her talent is certainly one of them. I loved this script because it represented a journey towards motherhood that I'd never seen before and a conversation about motherhood that I hadn't seen. I also love the confidence it takes to tell a story about this kind of woman in this 1970s crime thriller genre, to center this woman and other characters like Cal and Terry, who are so often on the fringes of these familiar and beloved movies, or not included in them at all, but most certainly were there and were also people who felt the fallout from that normally what would be the central character's actions. I also, I'm such a fan of Julia's, and even more so after getting the opportunity to sit down with her and talk about Jean and talk about her journey and talk about this script and what inspired it. And Julia spoke a lot about growing up loving these 1970s crime thriller dramas and not really seeing herself in them, or seeing herself in them so briefly. And then as soon as the action kicks in, the women and children get shuttled off to safety, and the lens swings and follows the men into the fray. And I so appreciated her intentional swinging of that lens in a totally different direction, and the care with which she approaches every character's story. She and Jordan are such beautiful writers, and they were the most generous and kind and exciting collaborators to be working on this project with.
And the way that the movie is kind of in conversation and is even sort of a critique of these 70s and 80s crime thrillers, were those movies that you already knew? Like, did you sort of already appreciate what the movie was trying to say and do in regards to those other films?
Not particularly. And that was one of the things that was very exciting about it. It felt like a space that was really foreign to me. I'd seen The Godfather and had seen the door get shut in Kay's face. But I hadn't seen Thief, which is Michael Mann's first film, which was a big inspiration for Julia and Jordan. I hadn't seen Gloria, which a bunch of folks have been asking about as we've been talking about the film. It was new territory for me, and I appreciated the opportunity to dive into it a little bit and get to know the genre better before being a part of helping subvert it.
And what did you feel like you took from that, from watching the performances of like Tuesday Weld or Jenna Rollins or Diane Keaton? Like, what were you taking from those performances?
Just that these actresses were so phenomenal and made such a lasting impact in their short amount of screen time because they were so good. And they weren't, I don't want to say they were wasted in these films because they were so fantastic, but I could have watched a movie about just their characters, especially Diane Keaton and Tuesday Weld. I could have watched a whole movie or a sequence of movies about what happened to them. And so this was an opportunity to tell a new story, but about one of those women.
I know in I'm Your Woman, at the beginning of the film, your character Jean, there's something almost childlike about her. She kind of doesn't really know how to take care of herself. And then she suddenly is left really on her own with this child, this baby that's not her own. How do you describe sort of her like journey? What for you is like the trajectory that she's on through the course of the film?
It's frame by frame by frame. That's what I keep saying. And I appreciate the confidence it takes to approach her journey at that speed, not to sort of manipulate the character into growing faster or taking bigger leaps than feel authentic to who she is. This is a woman who, when we meet her, is lost inside her own head. She's trapped in her past in a lot of ways, trapped in her former dreams and desires, and she's so sad. This change is thrust upon her. She's not someone who, when we meet her, I think is particularly interested in change and is a reluctant action hero as the film moves on.
There are lots of scenes in the movie where she's just by herself. And so we're, as viewers, kind of just watching you kind of exist. And there's something really internal about your performance. Was that a challenge? Was it difficult to have to kind of like show so much of what's going on to her sometimes without words, without like big scenes? Like you kind of just had to get those things across just by existing.
Yeah, definitely. I trusted Julia and Jordan inherently throughout that process, really relied on their feedback, Julia in particular, about whether or not it was working, about whether or not enough was coming across for you to remain invested in Jean's trajectory. I feel like there are so many movies that sit with men that way, movies that we love, because what a gift it is to be able to observe someone who doesn't know that you're observing them, to be able to just look at the human condition and maybe see ourselves reflected back, and especially when we can see ourselves reflected back. So it was challenging as someone who probably cannot be considered a quiet woman, finding that slower internal rhythm and figuring out why and when and how she used her voice was a welcome challenge. We talked a lot about, you know, what Jean's voice sounds like as someone who doesn't use it very often and that she's uncomfortable with it. There's a really small moment that I love so much and loved finding as an actor, but also loved seeing play back in the edit, where Jean has been alone for quite some time with just a baby. And there's a knock at the door and she just says, "Hello." But it's as if she hasn't spoken in quite some time, and it sort of squeaks out in a voice that feels unfamiliar.
And I hope this doesn't seem too personal, but it really struck me that both with Mrs. Maisel and here, you're playing these parts of women kind of exploring motherhood, finding themselves in motherhood, their own relationship to motherhood. And you yourself don't have children, and I'm just curious what it's like exploring the sort of the emotions of those characters.
It's really interesting as something, as you pointed out, that feels fairly foreign as a woman who hasn't yet grappled with my own experience of motherhood. I was so inspired and sometimes frustrated and often moved by the response to Midge's relationship to motherhood, and was surprised by the volume of the response and the passion behind the response. And I feel like through preparing these roles, I've heard from so many women from so many different experiences who bonded with their children in different ways and different times, whose children came into their lives through so many different paths, through having them themselves, through adoption, through surrogacy, through, you know, there are so many ways to become a mother, through being a step parent. There are so many different pathways. And it feels like up until this point, we've really seen so few of them explored on screen. And obviously Jean's journey is very unique in that this child enters her life, and spoiler alert, are we at that point still? Spoiler alert, that this child enters her life and she doesn't know where it came from, or she's been told something that she may or may not believe is true. But her journey towards realizing that she is capable and that she is still a woman, even though she couldn't have children herself, that she is still a mother to this child, even though he came into her life in an unexpected way, and that she loves him and he loves her back, is monumental for her. And I would love to see more stories that reflect the many that I've heard or been told or discovered over the last couple of years.
There's a beautiful scene in the film where your character of Jean is in a diner eating with Cal, played by Arunze Kenny, and she talks about how she's had a series of miscarriages, and that's why she, you know, had sort of put aside feelings of motherhood or thinking she was going to be a motherhood. And there's something so vulnerable in that scene. And it's something, it's like a conversation we just don't see people having very often. Were you struck by that scene when you, even when you first read it?
Absolutely. And again, having spoken to so many women who have undergone their own experiences with fertility, so many of which, as a woman, I had never heard before. I mean, I'm grateful also that in this moment, we're having a larger conversation about miscarriages, about losing children. That wasn't even happening when we began preparing this film. And it feels radical in a way that it shouldn't anymore, considering that women have been having children since the beginning of time, that we're only just now bringing some of these conversations and these struggles to the surface. We talked so much in the making of this film about quiet women and about how many women don't choose to be quiet, but feel that they have to be and have to live in these struggles alone, when the reality is we have so much more in common than we think we do. What's stopping us from being able to reach out to each other to feel seen and feel heard and feel supported?
I know maybe the answer to this is kind of obvious, but is a scene like that, is that an example of where having a female filmmaker, someone like Julia, and that perspective matters and makes a difference? Like, I don't know if a man would direct that scene, would understand the emotions of that scene in the same way.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's hard to say. Not all women are the same and not all men are the same. I'm sure there are men out there who could direct a beautiful version of this scene. And I would like to think that it's Julia as Julia and with her lived experience and the lived experience of people in her own life that she's been inspired by that made this particular scene come to life. But definitely there is an unspoken intimacy that comes and a trust that comes with working with someone who it feels like can see you or that you share some kind of experience with. Obviously, we are very different. Julia has two beautiful children, and as we said, I don't. And not a whole lot of my friends have children either. So we're in very different places in our lives, but there is that, you know, je ne sais quoi that happens in a room when a story feels, has an added layer of authenticity.
And now you're also a producer on I'm Your Woman. This is the first feature film that you've produced. Tell me about that. Like, what made you kind of want to take that step in asserting yourself with this project in particular?
I'd been interested in producing for a couple of years and been really inspired by other actresses who had made the move into producing and the kinds of work that they were creating and the kind of space that they were creating for other women. And I hadn't found the right project or the right collaborators to be able to step into that space for the first time. And as I said, I was so moved by this script and loved meeting with Julia. And I'm so grateful that Julia and Jordan Horowitz, who are married and who co-wrote this script together and who work together so often and have this really special working relationship, made space for me and invited me to step into that role for the first time. I'm really grateful that, you know, Jordan, as my fellow producer on this project, not only lifted me up as, you know, a man in a position of influence and leadership, but also mentored me, took me under his wing, and then pushed me to use my own voice and made space for me to earn the title and to take a seat at the table, and taught me in real time what it looks like to pay it forward.
And what do you feel like you learned from the process? Like, what is there something about just making a movie that you know now that you didn't know before you produced I'm Your Woman?
I have a whole new respect for the amount of time it takes to bring a project from the earliest stages to fruition. Julia and Jordan had written the script a number of years before I first read it, so they had done a lot of that work before I came on board. But we continued to develop the script together and spent many, many hours in conversation about Gene and with Amazon about how we wanted to make this film and what kind of support we felt like this film needed and deserved, and are so happy that they were on board to provide that. you know, we worked together to cast these other roles and bring on all of our department heads and the other collaborators who brought this film to life. And this process of many months before we actually stepped into formal pre-production and got to Pittsburgh and got the, you know, the whole thing set up before we actually started shooting, and then spent this, what feels like almost a blip on the radar, shooting this film before we entered into a month-long post-production. I have a whole new respect for how many different collaborators there are at so many different points in the process, and how long it takes, and how many people's labor and love it takes to birth an artistic baby. And I had been lucky to have been able to look up close, not as a producer, but as an actor who was on set every day, at that process on The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, because it's such a large production. And I felt like I had gotten a little bit of a taste from afar, but it was a fantastic experience and made me a better actor too, to be able to spend that much time with your collaborators, with the director, with the writers, with, you know, my fellow producer, and to see the sets come to life and the world being built before actually arriving on set added more context and enriched the performance greatly.
You know, the movie just has this sense of awareness, like it sort of knows what it's doing in this wonderful way. And there's a scene kind of late in the film. Jean has kind of gone on the run, and she's hiding with Cal's family, and she's having this conversation with Cal's wife, and it's talking about all the problems she's having. And Cal's wife, who's a Black woman, tells her, you know, you think you have it tough, you don't really have it tough. And there's just something about that scene that's, again, that's really surprising for the movie to just have the patience and to take the time to even have that conversation. Like, what did you think of that scene and the fact that, you know, the movie is able to make space to acknowledge something like that?
It feels like the movie couldn't exist without it, you know, as a movie that's taking place in the 1970s, that is dealing with characters who live on the fringes of films like this, but also in different ways on the fringes of society, on the fringes of the status quo. It feels like we couldn't make this movie without that acknowledgement. And I appreciate that scene in particular, it's only about four lines. Jean says to Terry, you know, it's worse for me because we have a kid. And Terry says, nothing's worse for you. And she says, you don't know that. And Terry says, yes, I do. And that's all it is. It's a simple and quiet acknowledgement that these two women, although they share a lot in common, quite literally, they share an ex-husband in common. You know, they share this life of secrecy and crime. Terry was, in some ways, where Jean is not that long before we meet her in this film. They have a lot in common, but they have something that creates an enormous divide between them. And it's an opportunity for Jean to begin to realize that and for our audience to acknowledge it. I appreciate how quietly and deftly and importantly they were able to have that conversation in this film.
And now, as much as the film is a character study, it also is a pretty kicking action movie. There's a big sort of nightclub shootout sequence that has, like, I think hundreds of extras in it. It's super chaotic. Like, did you enjoy that aspect of the film as well?
Yeah, this film was a dream because we got to do it all. We've spent a great deal of time talking about some of my favorite moments in the film, the quiet ones, the ones where where we get to explore these characters' emotional wells and what makes them who they are and what makes them tick. And we talk about this slow, quiet change. But you can't have a 1970s crime thriller without a car chase and a shootout and a little bit of senseless violence. And I appreciate that we got to challenge ourselves with both. I got to run in platform heels down a really rickety old staircase and crawl on the floor in pools of fake blood and run into people and drag 200-pound men out of cars and slide around in a 1970s sedan. You know, I got to learn to shoot a gun. It was good fun too.
I know the movie, and I don't think I'm spoiling anything here, like, ends with kind of my favorite kind of last shot, where it's just like a single long take of someone and then sort of like the credits start and we're still just watching you kind of driving this car. And now, do you know that that's going to be the credits when you're doing it? Like, I'm always so, like, fascinated by how those moments come together.
Yeah, that was always the last shot in the film, was essentially the beginning of the next chapter in Jean's life. This next chapter with Jean and Cal and Terry and Paul and Harry. I think there's a whole nother film that begins with that ending shot.
What does the title mean to you? I know that it's a line of dialogue that Tuesday Weld says in Thief, but with regards to the motion picture, I'm Your Woman, what does that title mean to you?
It means a few things. It feels like a reclaiming of what it means to be a woman and what it means to be someone's woman. You know, we've heard the phrase a lot, I'm your man, you know, I'm your man. Like, I also love the idea that this is a little bit, I'm your woman. Choose me. I'm here and I'm ready and I'm waiting. I don't think that's where it starts, but I do think that's what it takes on as Jean's journey unfolds. Yeah, it feels like an exploration of womanhood and motherhood and who, you know, who has ownership over women. And I think that changes a lot throughout this story.
And now you also recently appeared in The Golden Arm, which was a short film. It was directed by Sam Raimi on the short-lived platform Quibi. And like now that like the dust has settled, like how do you feel about that in retrospect? Because the film that you were involved with sort of became, for a lot of people, like the singular avatar of Quibi, like pro or con. And like, how do you feel about that?
It was such a surprise because I did one episode or one story in what was a series that was completely shot. And it was strange and fun and weird, but there were so many strange and fun and very weird projects on Quibi. So I'm not entirely sure what made this one stick out so much. In some ways, it was frustrating because it felt like this one clip had been taken out of context and became the butt of a joke about Quibi in this weird moment that we're living through. And listen, whatever gives people a sense of relief, I'm all about. You know, this is a really tough moment and a really tough time. It was odd. Yeah, I mean, I had an incredible meeting with Sam, who I don't know if you've ever met him, but he's one of the single most delightful people I have ever met. And he loves what he does more than most people I've ever met at that age who have retained this childlike joy and curiosity about what they do. And it's infectious. It's not necessarily the kind of story that I would have sought out or would have been involved in, but it felt like real Sam Raimi camp and practical horror. It felt very nostalgic in a way that was appealing. It was a 5-day shoot. It felt like an opportunity after a really difficult season of Maisel to screw around. I don't know if I'm allowed to say fuck around for lack of a better word, for a couple of days and just have fun with a group of people who love doing what they're doing. And so in some ways, it was a bummer because it became this thing that people made fun of ceaselessly when, for me, it was an experience that was filled with joy. It was so much fun. And I do wish that, you know, that it could have in some way been recognized for that rather than as this thing that became an outlet for our fury at this moment or all of our mean-spirited jokes. What a weird moment in time.
And now, as we've been talking to people and everybody, you know, has just been spending months and months and months at home, and so pretty much everybody has been spending way too much time watching stuff, what is some stuff that you've been watching? Like, is there anything that you would, like, recommend to other people that they should watch?
Totally. It's not incredibly highbrow, but I took great solace in many seasons of Survivor and then moved on to a History Channel show called Alone. Have you ever seen or heard of this show?
I've only seen or heard of it in other interviews with you.
Yeah, I've talked about it a lot. I'm very passionate about Alone. Yeah, it's a show about survivalists who get dropped into the wilderness and they just have to survive for as long as they can. And it's actually incredible and made me want to go take some survivalist courses and learn how to live in the woods. The Great British Baking Show. People are just so nice. And we need that right now. They just love baking so much. And Succession. I was late to Succession. Succession is amazing, and I'm eagerly awaiting the next season.
Any movies?
Yes, I was about to say, I went back and watched a lot of beloved films from the 90s and early 2000s. Went back and watched a whole bunch of the Christopher Guest movies and The Truman Show and Clue. What else? We've been watching a lot. We've been at home.
Well, I'll definitely be adding I'm Your Woman to my list of things to watch. You know, Mark, I loved when you were talking to Rachel about actors who sort of disappear inside their characters. You know, people like Philip Seymour Hoffman and Viola Davis and Frances McDormand. You know, it's actually one of the reasons I'm so eager to watch Nomadland, which stars Frances McDormand. Like, I keep hearing from folks who've seen it that her performance is stunning, and I really, really want to see it. But it's not available to stream yet, right? Have you seen it?
I have seen Nomadland. You should definitely see Nomadland. Frances McDormand is really terrific in that. I always like hearing actors talk about other performers that they like or what they sort of take from other people in both a, like a fan way, but also in like a professional sort of cribbing from people kind of way. I liked that she was so candid about that. And I also really appreciated how candid she was about, you know, the kinds of roles she sees herself playing now that she's getting offered, you know, these mother roles and sort of how that relates to her and herself and what how those performances are sort of developing as she goes along.
Oh, yeah, she's great. You know, I was actually thinking about whether Manhattan is streaming anywhere so I could go back and watch it. She's phenomenal in that. But, you know, something that I watched this weekend was One Night in Miami. And it was so fun sort of watching the tweets come in from Regina King, like she was tweeting about it, who obviously directed the film. And I really, really loved the title card for the movie. It was so striking, you know, just the blue water from the pool and Muhammad Ali under there. It was so, so good.
I'm always a fan of movies where the title card comes like well into the movie. And I think you're like 8-12 minutes into the movie before that title card comes up. It's one of my favorite things. I love it when that happens. Have you watched anything else?
Well, you know, I'm still on my HGTV kick because, you know, I spend a lot of time in my apartment, obviously, and you just start to notice things that bother you, or you're sort of like, am I over this paint? Should I repaint? Or I have a lot of scuffs on my coffee table that bother me and I want to repaint it, but that involves like renting a sandblaster or whatever they're called. I don't know. It just is always a lot of work and I always think I'll get around to it, but I never do. But watching HGTV like helps me think that I'll eventually do it. I don't know.
See, my response to HGTV is usually like just stuff I don't like. So it's like, I think it like helps you to like realize what you want or do like, because I'm like, oh, that's awful. Oh, I would never.
What it makes me think about is I wish I knew more people that were handy so that they could help me with these projects. But it's also like, who wants to spend their time repainting a coffee table? It's hard to get people on board with that. But enough about me, Mark. What have you been watching?
Well, I picked up what you were suggesting the other day. I watched Night Stalker. It's obviously the story of Richard Ramirez. There's a lot of that's creepy about it. And then the story of the two policemen who, you know, were really instrumental in finding him was fascinating in itself. But that's like, was such a classic Netflix docuseries in that it's like four episodes. Easily could have been two. Maybe you could stretch it to three. But there's so many just random shots of like a cat or like birds flying off a power line. They're just like, I don't need any of this. So I enjoyed it, but
I don't know. Like, it still left me terrified even with those moments. You know, I used to be somebody that didn't think anything of the fact that I would take my trash out at like 10:30 at night. It's just like the time that I would get around to it and who cares what time it is. And now it's like the most terrifying thing. I am all about taking my trash out at 4 p.m. now just to avoid living in fear those like 20 steps that I need to take outside.
I fully thought of you after I watched it because I had to do that. It was night and I was like taking the trash out and I was just like, there's no one there. There's never been anyone there. There's not going to be someone there today just because you watched The Night Stalker today. I had to talk myself into it that like nothing would happen.
Well, Mark, you're reasonable. I am not. I still think about all the what ifs. I just rather not chance it.
Well, I definitely kept thinking about people, even in the 80s, living in the metropolitan area of Los Angeles, not locking their front door, and also having like the back of your house. Apparently, everyone, that's sort of a security soft zone. It really had me thinking a lot about like the security of my house and like what are like the insecure areas where someone could conceivably break into my house.
Well, you know, it's funny because I was talking to a friend of mine about the docuseries and, you know, she's a little bit older than me. And she was telling me how when she was little, she would sleep under the window in her parents' bedroom because the thinking was in her mind, she was like, if he were to come in through the window, he would step on me. And I could scream, and that would alert my parents that someone's in the house. And I'm just like, I couldn't even imagine thinking that way, to have that like idea of like, we have to strategize on how to keep the family alive. Like, that's mind-boggling.
What? That's crazy. Wow. Now, Yvonne, what are we going to have next week?
Yes, next week we've got two guests on the podcast, Christina Applegate and Linda Cardellini. They'll talk about their Netflix show, Debt to Me.
This was written by women, directed by women, with the exception of Abe, and really exploring all of our real best friends and friendships, with, of course, this very extraordinary circumstances around them, lies and dead people and all of the kind of craziness that we go through. At the heart of it is a true friendship. And that's what I think is so beautiful about the show.
We'll hear Yvonne's chat with Christina and Linda in our next episode.
The Envelope, the podcast, is hosted by me, Yvonne Villarreal, and by my colleague, Mark Olson. Our producer is Shannon Lin, and our executive producer is Abby Fentress-Swanson. Our audio engineer is Mike Heflin, and he also made our theme song.
If you like The Envelope, the podcast, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a 5-star review on Apple.
The Envelope is created by the journalists at the LA Times. Right now, access to facts has never been more important, and the Times is in the business of reporting them. Stay connected and subscribe, because your subscription supports the production of podcasts like this one and our award-winning journalism. Visit latimes.com/supportlatimes to subscribe.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.